And we're back.
Hey, that was my line.
You were looking at your screen.
I know. I'm trying to. I'm multitasking. I'm doing a desired state configuration on three different systems.
I got your back. Thanks, I got your line. That's about the only part of your job I could do. Nice. And we're back. Nice. Rick.
Welcome back. If you just joined us again in the live stream or if you're watching this in replay mode, we're joined here with Mr. Corey Hines from Hull Systems.
Absolutely.
Or HOL. Is it HOL Systems?
Hull
Systems. And I'm Rick Claus, Senior Technical Evangelist at Microsoft. But we are going to be talking in this section about a technology that people are very passionate about, VDI.
I've always wanted to ask you this.
Yes?
Is Santa actually your brother?
Santa? What? Yes. Santa, my brother.
Santa Claus, Rick Claus.
Yeah, well, let's just say I've heard every joke in the book growing up, going through school with the last name of Claus. And even more funny is that my son is actually born on December 25th.
Oh, no.
So that's a little tidbit that. You might not know.
Wow, that's so awesome.
His name is not Nicholas or Sam.
That's awesome.
He's born on December 25th.
That's awesome.
Was not planned. Was not planned that
way. It was just a present, I'm sorry.
Just no. We're going to be talking about Windows Server 2012 R2 Preview, and this module we're going to be talking specifically about VDI infrastructure and Server 2012 R2. Like we had been mentioning in previous sections, in previous modules, 2012 introduced a lot of changes and a lot of new ways of being able to do things. 2012 R2 simply provides some additional functionality and also a more descriptive way of talking about this. It leverages, based on how you want to pronounce the emphasis. It goes in and manages and uses all the underlying changes in infrastructure.
Yeah.
And to their advantage.
I had a chunk of my career, which is like 2007 to 2010, where I did a lot of VDI. Mm-hmm. And there's a large period of time where I did a fairly significant number of training events around the Microsoft Citrix vAlliance partnership. And you know, went around and did consulting, did training, did just a lot of stuff around that sort of area, because VDI became very, very hot back in like 2008, 2009. You couldn't go to a customer without them looking at you and going, "We want VDI." Why do you want VDI? Because it's cheap. Let's back up for a second. So it was extremely popular, and you know, Windows with Windows Server 2008 came out with a very simple rudimentary VDI implementation. And we kind of went, okay, yeah, you get it, but you know, the solution really at that stage was Microsoft and Citrix with vAlliance. You put Zen Desktop on Hyper-V with Virtual Machine Manager, and you know, AppV and Terminal Server and all these components, and you build a really good VDI solution. With Windows Server 2012, it's a massive, massive, massive enhancement to what Microsoft can do now in the box natively mm-hmm. with VDI.
Right.
And it's one of those points where you know, all of a sudden you go, I can take it seriously now, because the scale is there, the manageability is there. You can do some pretty robust VDI implementations with just what's in the box. And I think they've done some test cases at both MMS and TechEd where they've had thousands of desktops running, you know, with just a Microsoft stack running on VDI. And so what we're going to try and do in here is take you through all that, mm-hmm. show you what those components look like, how you do basic configuration, and you know, and where the incremental enhancements are for R2. One of the big questions that you know we'll address kind of towards the end is you know, okay, well, Microsoft and Citrix still have vAlliance; they still kind of jointly do a lot of things, and there is still a place for that, mm-hmm. but it's changed a little bit, right? Because you know where what you could do in the box was here, now it's way up here. And there's still place for the, you know, like, for example, a Zen desktop on Hyper-V implementation. But the criteria that you would use to go down that road versus stay with just, say, a native one have changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's now more about flexibility of management and the different scenarios you might want to address and that really fine-grained level of control you're getting to, you know, certain protocols and, you know, this much bandwidth for video and this much for audio. And, you know, I want to go to all sorts of different devices on one experience where that becomes more prevalent.
So challenge-wise, basically, you're dealing with an environment where you've got all your user community and the users that are using your resources are going to be using a variety of different types of devices. Some of them are traditional PCs. Some of them are new touch-based systems, new touch-based laptops. Some of them are going to be tablet-based. And then also a whole variety of other devices as well, mobile devices, third-party developers,
you know,
and that sort
of
stuff.
We've moved into an era of app-centric delivery, mm-hmm. on app-centric users, where, you know, in the past with VDI, the big push for VDI was I want to get a desktop on any device, so no matter where you are, you can work in an application, because a Windows desktop was really the only delivery mechanism for an application. Now, as we move into applications being decoupled from the desktops, and you've got applications delivered by various stores and storefronts, the need for the Windows desktop to deliver the applications has lessened a little bit, and we've moved into more of this area of consumerization of IT, different devices, and Adam's going to talk a lot about that in the next module that we're going to do this afternoon.
Right.
But it doesn't lessen the need any for VDI, but it does help scope the scenario a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And those are some of the things that you're talking about, where you've got now very particular scenarios where VDI is usable and is the right choice. It's not kind of a one solution fits everything scenario.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about devices. We're talking about ways of being able to access applications and data on those devices, but also doing it in a way that you're going to be making sure that you're able to control those devices, control the experience of what the experience is going to look like, and also making sure that the data is supposed to be on those different types of devices,
mm-hmm.
Either through a native, I'm going to go off and access it directly on that device, or through a session-based or through a desktop exposed-based version of VDI solutions, where we're going with this. With a view of using the VDI example for why I use Microsoft VDI, the idea is being able to give a consistent user experience across different types of devices, being able to give access and grant access to corporate applications and corporate data from any device, any location, and also being able to balance off that user requirements and also corporate compliance to make sure that you're not just having the gates that are open the way that it all looks.
And I would say, like, one thing to take away from this slide is it says why Microsoft VDI. This is almost like why VDI in general, because it doesn't matter who you go to, they're going to say sort of all the same things.
Right.
But the key thing here is a Microsoft VDI stack with Windows Server 2012, Windows Server 2012 R2 can do all of this.
Mm-hmm.
2008, it couldn't without adding Xen Desktop on top.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it can do all of this. And I think that's an important takeaway for everybody to come out of this with,
right.
Is that you can do a very rich, very robust VDI deployment with what you get in Windows Server.
Why don't we take a look at it, my friend? Server 2012. What kind of environment do we have to be able to show?
I've got right a now. Bunch of things here. Let me just real quick have a look down, guys. I need to reconnect to the server to get the screen resolution right. Why won't it let me connect? Oh, hold on. Bear with me 1 second. As I click things feverishly.
There we go. Yeah, let's see. We've got one platform, one experience, and then we've got multiple deployment choices and options.
All right, so first of all, within Windows Server 2012, for those of you that did remote desktop services in the past, you had like Start Menu, All Programs, or Admin Tools, and you had a little node of remote desktop services tools. They're all gone. They don't exist anymore. And so for those that do RDS-type configurations, one of the things that one of the first questions they get is, how do I find all the tools? Where do I get them? The answer is, this has all been bundled in the Server Manager now. So all your remote desktop services components are now just part of Server Manager. And when you come in there for the first time, it can be a little confusing because of some of the new design that's in Server Manager, just trying to find things. Once you find everything, it's a piece of cake. But like you come in there for the first time, you start going, well, I want to configure the port that RDP uses. You got to find it now. So there'll be a little bit of a learning curve, I guess, the simplest way to put it. So we come in here, we've got this overview pane that allows us to do basic tasks. So for example, I've got virtualization host servers and desktop pools. I've also got tasks for adding session host servers. And we'll get into this as we work through the slide deck, where session host becomes part of VDI. Because in a Microsoft definition of VDI, it's not just Windows 8 in a VM or Windows 7 in a VM. A terminal server, and I'll just use that as a generic term, the official name is Remote Desktop Services Session Desktop, but terminal server, that's what the regular IT guys call it. A terminal server is, an equal citizen as a solution for VDI.
Right. Everyone jumps to going to a full desktop for everybody.
And that's the wrong choice. In fact, 90% of the VDI consulting I did wound up in terminal server deployments because it was simpler, cheaper, easier, and quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some information on that a little bit later on. But this is where you come within the UI to sort of manage it all. So you've got this overview pane with this deployment area, and this is where you would actually add components. For example, a licensing server. I don't have a licensing server.
It's a demo environment.
Yeah.
You have to have one, obviously, but
yes, you
demo
do.
Environment.
Where I can add my RD gateway components. It just does the server manager wizard stuff to add the roles and features to the server.
And again, just to clarify for people, you got to this area pre-configured already to
I
speed
did, yes.
things up?
You're right, I did. I installed the I set all this up last night because it takes a little bit of time to get everything configured.
Instead of a 90-page document about how to set up the different pieces and it's all there, now it's a wizard interface
yep.
from the server manager when you do a role deployment.
Exactly.
To be able to go off and to say, you know, let's do a quick deploy of the basic setup of what it looks like.
Exactly.
And then you
right.
can configure it. So in case anyone's wondering how you got that little special diagram thing, it's simply
yeah.
going
so for example, to Rick's point, if I wanted to turn this guy's server 4, and I think I will just for fun, into a member of my VDI deployment, I come in here and within server manager I've got role or desktop and I've got this new RDS node.
Right.
And this has two options, quick deploy and standard deploy. Now, if you ever want to, you know, go online and look up a demo of Windows Server 2012 VDI, there's tons of recorded demos of this.
Mm-hmm.
If you do quick start, all you need is a VHD, and you're done.
Right.
So it's going to go through and say, oh, you want to do a quick setup of VDI, give me a sysprepped Windows 8 VHD, and it'll produce everything for you on one server.
Right.
Which is what I did to get my initial configuration, then I scaled it out from there.
Right.
So I removed some roles, I added some roles, and I configured it. But it's a real simple, easy way to get started. A standard deployment, you would choose, and you can see this in the dialog boxes that change, you choose the individual servers where individual roles actually reside. And so when you run that wizard, the output is something that looks like this. So on the overview pane is where you'd configure and add different servers to the mix. For example, I want to add an RD virtualization host server, or I want to add a session host server, web access, all those different components. And then as you scroll down, sorry, wrong page. As you go over under service, you scroll down. This is your server manager health view of all the servers that are involved. And then you begin to create collections. And we'll come back to these collections in a little while and look at the properties of them.
Right.
The collections are where all the work is actually done.
Right.
Collections are simply defined a group of either applications, desktops, be them terminal server or virtual machine based, that you manage as a unit. And you assign permissions as a unit, and you assign settings like profile disks and storage point as a unit. So you can have many, many, many collections that are, you know, different amounts of RAM, different amounts of CPU, different users can use them, different storage points. You can have many, many collections.
Flip back over to the one that's already done and configured, if you could, just for a second.
That's this one here.
That you're on there. I go back to the view of the different components that are there. So licensing is a licensing server. You have to go off and install your terminal, your RDS licensing CALs on that guy there. You've got your gateway. The gateway basically gives you access to...
Yeah, so the RD gateway is, think of it as a reverse proxy in a way. And if you've never deployed one of these, you should. So if you right now have a firewall and you have ports, so you can RDP to servers internally and you just do port mapping, you're doing it wrong. You need an RD gateway. What an RD gateway will do is you connect to a web page. Or you can do this directly with MSTSC under Settings Advanced or Advanced Settings. You put in the name of your gateway server. And what it's going to do is it's going to create an SSL session to that server, tunnel your RDP through it, and then once you reach the gateway server, it'll redirect to the appropriate internal physical host.
Right.
So you have one published endpoint over SSL that you connect to the gateway and then from the gateway go to any internal host. And then on the gateway, you can configure policy like smart card authentication required. You can implement NAP, network access protection. You
mm-hmm.
can implement health checking. You can implement session timeouts or do messaging. There's a whole administration interface to it. And the gateway hasn't really changed, even from 2008 all the way up through R2 and 2012. It's gotten a little better, sort of incremental improvement. They've added with R2 now a pluggable authentication model, so you can start adding things that are not just smart card and password,
right.
Like these, you know, token ID type setups or even biometrics type setups.
Mm-hmm. Flip back over to his demo sessions for a second, finish walking through the rest of the sort of stuff. RD web access component.
RD web access component is essentially the website that it's not required.
Mm-hmm.
It's required for some areas, but what it looks like is this. If I just go to, this is it right here. So it's published as a website. You put a certificate on it. You come in here and log on. I'm going to log on just as a user. Spelled it wrong. There we go. So I'm going to log on as Rick's hat.
My hat has a username in Contoso?
It absolutely does.
Oh, nice.
Your hat's the CTO of Contoso, dude. And what it shows you are your collections, right? And so this is where I would see things like remote app as an example,
right?
Which we're not going to get into that component today, or session desktops. And from here is where I choose, if I'm going to choose, for example, a pool desktop.
We can get into this in just a minute, but yes, we got pool desktop and private desktop.
And also connect to internal networks if there's a gateway in play, for example. But this is kind of the portal that you would come to. And this is customizable. It's a web app. You can actually go and you know, brand this for your company by editing the website.
Flip back over to the admin once again. That's the wrong one. There it is. RD Connection Broker.
The RD Connection Broker component is what ties everything together. So if you look at this from an architectural standpoint, if you're going to connect to a virtual desktop, there has to be a component in that virtual desktop environment that's going to figure out what your username is, what virtual desktops you're allowed to connect to, and what hosts those desktops actually reside on. And it acts as kind of a, you know, use the term broker, not proxy. Because if you look at the idea of, you know, buying a house, you go to a broker, the broker says, here's the house you want, handles the transaction, then steps away, and then you work and you live in the house. The connection broker is the same idea. When you go to connect to a virtual desktop, it knows where all the desktops are. It has the ability to start them if they're in a save state, and it can then go, okay, Corey, you want a virtual desktop? Let me get one ready. Here's the endpoint you RDP to, and then hands it off. You RDP to the desktop. This all happens automatically, and the broker steps aside. And all it's going to do is just track, okay, are you still logged on? So it can then put that back in the pool and allow someone else to use it down the road. Mm-hmm. And this can all be highly available, which we'll get into. So that's what that component's role is. And I'm willing to bet you're going to ask about the virtualization host.
I was just getting that one next, because actually there's a couple of questions in the queue about that.
I've now figured out your pattern, Rick. You've become predictable to me.
Oh, man. I've become redundant now.
An RDS session host is I hope you're never redundant, because that means there's two of you. An RDS session host is a terminal server. Lay that one to a side. The virtualization host is a service you add to a Hyper-V server, right? So in my case, if I look over on the side here, my RD virtualization host is HVL6. So this is a Hyper-V server that is going to contain VDI VMs. Mm-hmm. And then I've created pools of or collections of VDI VMs, one called pooled, one called private, that live on that virtualization host.
Okay.
And it's the virtualization host and the pools are all kind of, it's host agnostic. So when you choose a pool, you don't necessarily know which host the desktops are going to be on. The broker handles all that for you.
Right.
So someone just asked a question, does the RD gateway have WAN optimization? The gateway itself does not. The gateway itself is just a way of tunneling RDP through a single endpoint to hosts on your network.
Right.
RDP is highly WAN optimized now through the new RemoteFX enhancements.
Right. Which we'll talk about later on.
Yeah, and that also brings back, you know, that question of, you know, where does Citrix with their relationship with Microsoft plug into this? You know, they have WAN acceleration products that can enhance VDI. You know, Microsoft's relationship with partners is always one of the partner adds value. That's one of the values they add is some of their WAN acceleration products,
right,
where you can, you know, if you have really low bandwidth, adding in their WAN acceleration products can make that scenario better than just running it native.
Flip over here to the slides for a second, because we mentioned a little bit about the architecture for which way to go, and we briefly touched on the concept of sessions and full desktops and stuff like that. So I'm giving you an opportunity to grab a drink there. The right VDI architecture, you know, which is the right way to go? And the answer is always, as a consultant, it depends.
But
the way this guy builds out is...
This is a phenomenal slide. Yeah. This is one of the best VDI slides I have ever seen in my life.
I will pass it on.
In terms of getting a point across. No, you go ahead.
Yeah, I'll pass it on to
all right, build it up.
The TPM that went off and did this. So the idea behind this is which VDI architecture is going to be right for you. And you've got personalization level as an important thing that you want to be able to do. If you're doing session-based, you've got minimal personalization. It's got a good visibility of what you can do. If you're doing pooled VMs and then personal VMs, you obviously have more options to be able to look at for the different things. We'll talk about the difference between pooled and personal in just a second here. As far as app compatibility is concerned, again, session-based, which is, again, I don't want to use this, but it's for people that have been around the Microsoft stack for a while. Terminal services is what people are used to understanding what that means. Yep. That's basically you've got a server-based OS that's being able to be exposed and send up session or applications up to individual people.
By adding that level 4 desktop experience
right.
UI.
You got it. So there is less compatibility available in that because potentially the application you're trying to publish out does not support it on server or is not supported inside a terminal service environment or an RDS environment. Whereas pooled VMs and personal VMs, you've got full best experience to be able to go off and to manage those guys there. Ease of management-wise, interesting here, and this is where I like to always have the big flip on. With a session-based install, it's extremely easy to manage
it's
because you're managing
server.
one OS that you have to worry about patching, updating, and maintaining. Whereas pooled or personal VMs, you have multiples that you have to go off and manage. People forget that. If they go off and deploy a pooled environment or a personal environment for one-to-one relationships, you've got that same number of desktops that you have to now patch, even though they're not in a virtualized
and
space.
And pooled environments are even a little bit different and a little bit more difficult. I almost put in terms of ease of management, I almost put one star on pooled.
Right.
And my opinion, if you just go back to the slide for a second, my opinion is that pooled VMs are a one-star management and personal are a two-star management.
Oh, interesting.
That's my opinion. I'll explain why in a second.
Okay. Cost-effectiveness on sessions,
that's better cost-effectiveness
as opposed to licensing for individual pools and personals.
So to kind of make sure that everyone sort of understands what we're talking about here, session VMs is essentially terminal server.
Right.
Pooled VMs are a group of desktops where when you connect to it, you can get any one of the desktops. So if you want a physical analogy, it's a shared computer lab in a building.
Yep.
You're going to walk down, and if the machine you were at yesterday is busy today, you got to take the one next to it. And you can assume that every time you sit down, any changes you made are gone. Now, you can dampen that effect by using roaming user profiles and user state disks, folder redirection, all these types of things. But at the end of the day, it's a stateless machine, essentially. And then a private VM is, this is your VM, and no one else will ever use it, and you can do whatever you want with it. So back onto the slide for a second. If you look down the personal VM side, personalization, you're the admin of the box, you can do whatever you want. It's the equivalent of a physical machine in terms of your access to it.
That's virtualized.
Except as a VM, right? App compatibility, because it's your VM and you typically would have admin level access to it, you can do anything you want with it. In terms of ease of management, I give it 2 stars, not one, because you can manage these with things like with the same management tools you use for physical desktops.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have config man deploy the patches, for example.
Right.
And then for cost effectiveness, bit hard on storage, hard on RAM. You get a lot of kind of idle desktops nobody's using because someone goes home for the night, that personal desktop's not being used all night long. Pooled VMs, personalization, because you have to do some work to have settings follow users around. App compatibility, it's the same. Ease of management. When you're doing patching on pool desktops, typically pool desktops revert their state when you log off. Right? And we'll show you some of this in the demo in a little bit. But typically, they revert their state when you log off. So you log off the pool desktop, and any changes that were made in your session are gone, like deleted, because they use a snapshot rollback. So if you apply the patch and you log off, the patch is gone again. So you can't use traditional patching methods for things like antivirus or system patches and updates and that kind of stuff. You've got to use other methods rather than what you would use for a traditional desktop. So I think it's a little more difficult than that. In terms of cost effectiveness, you can have fewer desktops than you have people. So shift workers is a good example. And then, terminal server is tried and true and been around for years and years and years, and we know how to do this as an industry. It's a piece of cake, and that's always going to be, when you can, your best choice because it's got the most stars.
Advancing on this guy over here, you talked a little bit about the concepts that were explained on the slide over here for ease of deployment to make it very easy to go off and deploy, unified administration with a single interface, single console for where it goes, and then the best value with the concept of user profile disk. We'll go into more detail of each of these things in the upcoming slides and also with some demos that are coming up, and also flexible storage options and rich user experience. Now, from efficient management, simple deployment, and intuitive administration and scalability, you'd already gone ahead and deployed, and you showed us very briefly the wizard install to be able to go off and get the basics of it up and working.
Right. So let me show you how to create a pool of desktops here. So have a look on my screen for a second. So I've got two that are already created. That's all fine and dandy. I'm going to do another one. And so you'll see here when I go to do this, it's a pretty simple process. Collection name, we'll call this one Pool 2. So we'll just do Pool Desktops for this one. I'm not going to actually run. I'm not going to actually create them because it takes a little bit of time.
Yeah.
I've already got them done. So we'll kind of do the next cancel model here. Type pooled. You'll notice that you tell it to auto create. You can actually pre-deploy the desktops in some other. If you're like a desktop VM deployment methodology, you don't need to use Server Manager to actually create them. If they already exist, it can leverage that. Yep. And then it shows you the features you get between pooled and private within that helps you kind of make the decision. Permanent user assignment, administrative access, recreate and store user settings on a profile disk are the ones that are different. Virtual desktop template. So you always do this based on an existing template VM. Okay. So I have a VM out there on this host, which is called QuickMaster VM. And this is a very simple desktop that's essentially a sys-prepped copy of Windows 8 that's not domain joined.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got all my apps and all my software and my configurations in it. I can now, I can update this, I can boot it, configure it, sys-prep it, and shut it down again. I can put snapshots on it, and I can, essentially use this as an authoring environment for what my virtual desktops look like. But I've got to have one of those, and there's requirements on how you configure the operating system inside of this. Those requirements are documented on TechNet, but to be quite frank, if you do a quick config and grab the VM it creates, it does it all for you. It's the simplest and easiest way to get there. Even if you're planning on doing a standard configuration, run a quick config and then just grab the desktop it produces because it's done the 15 or 20 things inside the VM, the firewall rules, the group memberships, turning on the services that are needed to be considered valid as a template desktop. So you take that one. Virtual desktop settings. This is where, when you create it, it's sys-prepped, and as you create the virtual desktops, they've got a domain join. So you can either do an answer file through, the Windows client tools, the deployment workbench,
right.
and those files, or you can just come in here and go, just put it in the domain, please, and just be done with it. So we're going to just put it in the domain, please. Who's allowed to use it? How many? And the prefix, which I always find ironic, is poo. So we'll do pool 2. So they're going to create two desktops, pool 2-1, pool 2-2.
Yeah.
Where are they going to go? So, for example, if you have multiple Hyper-V hosts that have that remote desktop services, virtualization service installed, you can now go, I want to do 100 of them, do 25 at each of my four hosts,
mm-hmm.
and it'll do that for you. Where do you want to store them, right? And so this is where things like VDI have the ability to leverage all those advancements and features that are in the file server component of Windows Server. So when we talk about VDI getting so much better, it gets so much better because of all the infrastructure below it that's gotten so much better.
Right.
So we can throw it locally on the server, on a network share, on a CSV volume, so we can have clustered support now.
Yep.
So your virtual desktops can be clustered, and then you can specify a separate path for the parent disk. Now, we're not going to get into all the detail of, when you would do that versus when you wouldn't. If you want an entire day of VDI, Joey and I did one of those a month or two ago. So up on the Microsoft Virtual Academy, there's a jumpstart for Windows Server 2012 virtualization, where we go through this for about half an hour, this screen, and talk about all the different variations you might potentially want to do. So we'll throw them right now just on a local disk. User profile disk we'll talk about a little bit later on, so we're not going to get into that right now, but they help with reducing the network traffic related to personalization, and we're done. And so we click that. If we click create on this, it's going to take that template desktop, export it, and then create a series of new virtual machines that are based on that desktop.
Right.
Now, what it's actually going to create, we're going to go take a look at this. This folder right here is where my current desktop pool is residing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we look in this, you can see, that's my private one. Here's my pool right here. So I have two desktops, and these are, typical Hyper-V images. So I've got my virtual machine files, but I've also got a differencing disk and a snapshot, okay? The differencing disk, you'll notice, is very, very small. This contains only the personalization data that was done during sysprep, because the model that VDI uses is a shared base image with a differencing disk to represent each disk in the pool. And then it puts a snapshot on it so that you can actually roll back to that snapshot when you log off. The images folder contains the shared base image. So this is the image that everybody links to. So on disk, the pooled model is very efficient for storage, because it doesn't matter how many disks you create, they're all differencing disks. And every time you log off the pooled desktop, it applies a snapshot and reverts it back again.
And also, because it's on, in your case, scale-up file server, that's a SMB share.
Yep.
It leverages all the technologies for SMB3.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's also on a file server pool for disk that you've created in previous sessions,
yep.
I know that it's already set up to be used for tiering.
Yep.
And performance-wise, it's going to know that the most commonly accessed files over time is going to be the base,
right,
which is the parent, and it's going to move blocks of that file or the entire file over to the hot tier,
right,
which
the
is the fast
tier.
SSD yep. tier, to make it so that it becomes a faster,
absolutely,
optimized solution.
This scenario is leveraging all the storage technologies of storage spaces, scale-out file server, SMB multipass, SMB3, storage tiering, all those technologies that we did in the sessions yesterday. This is sitting right on top of those.
And the VDI administrator does not have to worry about any of that.
Nope.
The fabric was all managed by the administrator of the server to be able to set that up in the first place.
So here's what the VM looks like when it's created. There's the rollback snapshot that'll actually roll it back to. And pretty much away you go from there.
Now, another question that came up in the queue is this Hyper-V server that you're touching is obviously running server 2012 R2. You can have other images on this besides just the VDI images.
Yeah, but
virtualization,
I wouldn't.
Honestly. Optimization-wise, you wouldn't do that from a logistical standard, because it just doesn't make sense. It should be purpose designed for the VDI solution.
Now, can you, if you're setting up a
Hyper-V host
or a PLC, Hyper-V server, you throw whatever you want on there.
Right. And you also made a good point the other day, is that from a VDI perspective, licensing-wise, it actually is more cost-effective to be using Hyper-V Server 2012 R2 as the base OS, and then you have your guests licensed through your regular mechanisms of licensing your VDI guests, because Hyper-V Server 2012 R2 has all the proper functionality that you require to be able to go off and run a VDI solution.
Absolutely. I was going to answer a question in the queue, and my brain just went completely dead.
Oh, nice. Very, very good. Okay, so administration-wise, flip back the slide for just a second. You're using one interface, server manager, to be able to go off and do this.
But, like anything else, PowerShell.
PowerShell is the way to
The UI, when you get to thousands of VMs, use PowerShell.
There's a question that came up in the queue and also is represented here in the slide. Session shadowing is integrated into the console.
Yes. That was removed for a while, and people got kind of upset, and now it's back.
It's back in R2.
Yep.
A streamlined manageability of virtual machines for scalability. This is where you were talking about that base image versus private versus pooled in that kind of environment. The idea is that master images are for personals and pooled virtual machines. You're able to go in and basically worry about patching and updating that one individual system.
Yeah, and there's
and a difference in disk off of
two
that.
Things to talk about in here. One of them is in the case of private desktops, right? Private desktops don't get reset every time you log off, because they're treated like it's a physical machine in terms of management. It's a dedicated machine for you, dedicated installation of Windows. The problem you could potentially run into there is, if it's Patch Tuesday and you schedule a bunch of patches to deploy and they all hit at the same time on that Hyper-V host, you create an I/O storm and you run into a bad situation.
Right.
System Center Configuration Manager, if you're using that to deploy your patches, is smart enough to know that that particular instance of Windows is a VDI VM running on a shared host, and it's able to stagger all of that. So it can dampen that storm of I/O coming in.
Right.
And that's built into the Configuration Manager 2012. The second point there is regarding private or pooled images. So what I showed you here is a pooled image that uses a shared base. So how do you deploy patches into pooled images? And the answer is, within the administration tools for the pool, So if I go to the pool right here and look at all the different administration settings, down here on bottom are some information on the template. And on that, I have a recreate all virtual desktops. So the patching process for this becomes take your master image, boot it, patch it, fix it, get it stable, shut it down, and then come in here and do a recreate. And what that's going to do is delete all your virtual desktops and make them all over again. Before you go, oh my God, that's horrible, it actually can be pretty seamless because you come in here and you go, well, when do you want to do this through this user log-off policy? Do you want to do it right now? Like emergency, recreate them right now. Or when they log off, do it in the background. Or do it next Tuesday in the middle of the night. Right? So you get that ability to control when that happens. But this is, you know, when I talk about manageability of pool being a little more difficult than manageability of private, with private you can just say, hey, config man, deal with it. And, you know, the fact that they're VDI desktops, who cares? Just deal with it. With pooled, you've got to take a few more things into consideration, and you do things like this or variations of this depending on the management suite you're using. So,
questions came up, and it's a good point to be able to bring up this individual slide here, is best value for VDI for key platform capabilities. You've talked about this concept of the user profile disk in passing, talking about this with the pool desktop. Do you want to explain that a bit more for people?
Sure. And I, being completely honest, I had some trouble with this last night getting it to work, so I will attempt to get it to work here now. Okay. I tried a slightly different method. Here's the challenge that we get and the challenge that the user profile disk actually solves. Let me go grab... We're going to get some finger painting today here. Back to our good old finger painting.
The idea with user profile disk is it gives you the ability to have personalization on the pooled set of machines, right?
So if you take a machine, right? So and you structure a machine, you've got the operating system, you've got data, and you've got profile down here, right? And the thing with pooled desktops is that because they reset, these sections right here get deleted every time you log off.
By applying, in this case, it applies the snapshot.
By rolling the snapshot back again. So, you know, what does that do to users that want to have a file on their desktop or some kind of personalization, you know, when they move from machine to machine to machine? And the traditional answer to this has always been, you know, well, that's kind of what roaming user profiles do, right? Roaming user profiles store everything on a server, and when you log on, it downloads again. The problem with roaming user profiles has always been bloat on a machine. Like, the more machines you go to, your profile's everywhere now. And the bigger it gets, the more that you got this file server up here, the more you have to copy down every time you log on. You put that in a VDI scenario where you're logging onto the same piece of hardware over and over again, and you're generating excessive amounts of disk I/O and network I/O that's not needed. And even with, you know, offline files, folder reader, all those things combined, you're still having this burst of network and disk I/O every time you log on to reconstruct your profile. Because unlike it being preserved on the machine, it's removed by virtue of this being rolled back every single time. So what a user profile disk does, down here, is take those portions of the file system, your user profile directory, and put them in a VHD file. The VHD file lives on the same server or on the same share as your VM. So your VM's over here. That's your disk for your VM. And then you have this user profile disk, which is a VHD, that also lives there as well. And every time you log on, it simply takes that VHD and file system mounts it right into the VM. Mm-hmm. So you're copied down once, and when the VM is rolled back, because the VM's rolled back, but this disk over here is not, it never gets deleted. So the user profile local data is preserved on the machine through different sessions. And you can do this for session desktop terminal server stuff, and you can do it for pooled desktops. So you configure this right here in the settings of the collection. And so what I do is I enable user profile disks. I give it a path. I'm just going to use a local folder on this one. Let's do a folder called UPD. I'm just on the local disk. UPD, maximizing gigs, and then I can do some exclusions, like I don't want to put, you know, your music folder in there, for example, or whatever. And I can do some things, some other exclusions based on types of data. So we'll just apply that, and hopefully it'll take... There we go. So that looks like it worked. And so let me kind of show you that right in action. So I've got my user, Rick's... Rick's Tilly Hat. There we go. I'm going to log on. We're going to log on to the desktop pool. And so this is going to essentially pick one of the virtual machines in that pool. The connection broker right now is figuring out which one it is, and it's going to basically RDP me into it. And so your user's now, you know, logging on for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll let that just kind of sit in the background there and go. And so what's happening back in back on the disk demo stuff, I haven't activated anything.
That's all right.
Don't hate me for it. Don't hate the player, hate the game. Did I just say that? So if we look in here, it's kind of at a couple of things. If I look in Windows Explorer, and I look at the users folder, you'll see that Rick's Tilly Hat, where I would normally have a folder,
it's a
mount point.
It's a mount point to another disk.
And if I look at the settings of the VM, so let's
says
find...
It's also 20 gigs in size.
Also 20 gigs in size. Let's look at the settings of the VM real quick. So to do that, we're just going to come over here. I'm just going to refresh this view over here. And it'll show me that there's a user connected. So Rick's Tilly Hat's on this guy right here. So he's on pool-0 is the name of the VM.
Right.
Let's go look at that VM. So here's pool-0. Let's look at the settings on it. And this leverages, again, some of those technologies that came up in 2012, such as hot add on the SCSI bus. So there it is right there. It's hot added on the SCSI bus, a new VHDX file that's essentially named with the SID of the user account.
Right. In this case, it's stored physically on the machine that's running that particular pool.
Right. I was trying to put it on the file share with the VMs. That was giving me some trouble, so I just put it locally. You would ordinarily put this, you know, roughly where you're storing the actual VMs is where you typically put this.
Could be on a CSV volume if that machine is highly available.
Absolutely. And like I said, it should be on par with the VMs themselves.
Right.
So if the VMs are on a file server, it kind of should go there. If the VMs are clustered, it kind of should be clustered as well.
Right.
It doesn't have to be, but that's a, you know, a good practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I make a bunch of changes in here, like, you know, I copy some files in, for example. Let's go grab a file here.
Other questions that came up is, can you apply updates to the master image while the VDI user is logged in on these pool desktops?
While they're logged in, no. And that was the thing I showed a little bit earlier.
Right.
So we're gonna take a file here. You can set a policy that allows it to be set. We're gonna drop this right in on the desktop. So we were going to, but we won't. Point being, as you copy files in, this file will grow, or not this file, but the user profile disk will actually grow. It'll get a little bit bigger. It's a dynamic disk will expand as it's needed. And then the next time you log on, even if you put, you know, 10 megs or 10 gigs in your user profile directory, that doesn't have to keep copying back and forth,
mm-hmm.
right? If you're doing roaming user profiles, yes, when you log off, it'll copy to the file server. But when you log back on again, it won't have to copy it back down because it's already got the file in the disk. It just mounts it against a different VM.
And this,
so that user profile disk follows you from VM to VM.
Right. Within the pool.
Within the collection.
Right, the collection, sorry.
And so you would want, you know, if you have four collections, you would want four folders with four user profile disks.
Mm-hmm.
One sort of gotcha on that is you can have multiple collections that point at the same folder and put a user and point all your user profile disks from all your collections at the same folder. If you do, they'll overwrite each other and stuff will go all squirrely. So, you know, best practice, collection, put the user profile disk where the collection is in a unique directory for that collection, and you'll be golden.
The user profile disk also can help out with application compatibility, because basically you have a separate folder or separate file that's going to be written to by apps when they're coming off and writing stuff, as opposed to being on a on a shared location on one particular image that's out there. What about also tying in other additional things like folder redirection and user state environment virtualization, that sort of stuff?
So UEV, AppV, all become application delivery strategies for VDI, right? And so when you look at VDI as a strategy, there's four layers to it that you have to deal with, right? And so here's the stack of VDI, so to speak. And you've got the hardware, you've got the operating system, you've got apps, and you've got what's called user state, right? And so your VDI allows you to virtualize this stuff down here. But VDI by itself does nothing for user state or applications.
Right.
If you're going to be successful with VDI, you have to address those two. And you have to address those two before you implement VDI. The construction process of VDI kind of goes like this, but the consulting and design goes like this. Someone comes to you and says, hey, I want to do VDI. Okay, well, if you want to do VDI, in order for it to be successful, you've got to have good user state virtualization. Right. So you do
if
that.
If you don't, resolve that first.
You're going to have problems down the road. So right. You implement folder redirection, you implement roaming user profiles, all these things that allow a user state to be separated from the machine.
Right.
You then go, okay, how do applications, right? I got Office, I got other applications. How do I address those applications being decoupled from the operating system? And that's where technology is like, well, I can take them and I can put them up on a terminal server. Or I can take them and I can do something like AppV to deliver them. And you address that. So now the applications can be dropped in and removed on a whim. Now you're ready to do VDI. Because if you run into a situation where you do pool desktops and you just install the applications locally and you don't do anything for roaming user profiles, it's not going to go well. You're going to have issues. It's going to be hard to manage, expensive, and difficult. So you address those things first. They're outside the scope of what we're talking about, obviously. And they have nothing to do with VDI per se. Mm-hmm. They're just application user virtualization.
It's success factors, as you mentioned. You have to make sure they're addressed correctly first before you start to go and just dive into the silver bullet solution.
Absolutely.
We already mentioned how this leverages and uses all the technologies underneath the hood and underneath the covers for your data store, for your disks, for scale-up file server, being able to make sure you have enough CPU power, be able to run it, being able to make sure you have enough sessions to be able to get to it, and they have data tiering going off for your access, stuff like that. I'm assuming this also goes in and leverages all the same stuff on the virtualization side of things to make sure you don't have noisy neighbors taking place and to make sure you don't have any other constraints going on, because you can put quality of service on the network, quality of service on drive IOPS, and quality of service on bandwidth and stuff too.
And the way you would do that, quite frankly, is quite easy. So if I look at my master desktop here, anything that I configure on the settings of this guy, whether it be number of CPUs, such as I want 4 CPUs, I want only 75% of proc to be limited at any one point in time. I want all my VDI VMs to be not 100% in case other things are running, but 75% members. And then I go down to my disk controllers, and I go, you know what? No VDI VMs gets more than 120 IOPS. And I go to my network and I say, no VDI VM gets more than 10 megasecond of network bandwidth, or 100 megasecond of network bandwidth. 100 megasecond. What I've now done is I've implemented processor, storage, and network quality of service so that no single VDI VM can be kind of that nasty neighbor, that hungry neighbor.
And that was on the master one. You'd have to go in basically.
Now, I would recreate the pool or recreate the private to enforce that.
Right.
Exactly. Or I could just run a PowerShell script across it all.
and implement that.
You can make those changes live.
So this is the concept of fair share, basically, right?
No, it's not. Fair share is something different. This is putting QoS on the VM itself, leveraging the features of Hyper-V. Mm-hmm. Fair share is something that's there by default when you turn on the VM Hyper-V role for the 1 second, please. When you turn on RD virtualization host,
there you go.
God Almighty! So when you turn on RD virtualization host, who out there remembers something called Windows System Resource Manager? Rick?
Resource Manager?
Windows System Resource Manager.
Yeah.
You remember that?
It was used on individual servers to be able to make sure you could assign processes, specific chunks of resources and time on the system.
kind of, we might be talking about something slightly different. Windows Server 2003 for Terminal Server with the R2 release of 2003, in that add-on pack there was the WSRM. And if you ran WSRM, it would solve the problem of a user playing pinball on a terminal server. Because when you played pinball...
It's the same thing.
Same thing, okay. Yes. We're using different words, that's all.
I'm not a terminal services guy, I'm a server guy. So I use terminal server resource manager server, okay. to constrain resources.
So fair enough, but it's the same basic principle. You run pinball on a server and the processor goes to heck and everyone else sits there going, why is it so slow?
Mm-hmm. And so getting my high score.
It does. I don't remember what my high score was on pinball, but it was pretty up there. My wife and I, many years ago, were just bored one night. We tried to
beat each other on scores.
Yeah, I know. That's like, don't even start with me, people. It would prevent one user from using all the CPU and just kind of level it out a little bit. When you introduce VMs, the host has no insight into that. So FairShare knows about VMs and can make sure that you have a VM that all the I/O is equal among all the VMs. It's not quality of service where you're restricting or guaranteeing. It's making sure that if one of them makes more noise than the others, that one gets less attention, the others don't get choked out. That makes sense? So that's what FairShare is. So what's up next, Rick?
Storage options configuration. We already talked about this in passing, but simply making sure that you guys are aware of this, that fact that you can use direct attached storage, you can use network attached storage, or you can use clustered or SAN storage or the new SMB file share location for scale-out file server for where you're going to be putting your VDI images. It can and will use tiered storage to automatically optimize and do stuff for your performance.
Yep.
And then also go ahead and obviously reduce costs by disk deduplication. So those two things I want to ask you about.
Okay.
Can you show us that?
If
you haven't seen it, you know, go back to one of the earlier sessions. You'll be able to see our whole stuff and talk about storage, mm-hmm. Where we actually show moving data between the slower tier and the hot tier and back and forth.
Right.
This same principle applies to the VDI images and where they happen to sit.
So what I've done, and if you haven't looked at any of the storage stuff from previous sections, you'll want to look at that, or this might not make all that much sense.
Right.
But at a very high level, what I've done on my my volumes is I've enabled data deduplication. So I've installed the data deduplication role on both file server nodes, and I've configured it on the volume for VDI and basically said dedupe everything now.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that's done, I let that run overnight.
Because it runs on a scheduled basis.
Yep. Get dedupe status. And you can see that right now, it has saved me 31 gigs of space, right? So if I look at my file system, just my native file system, and look at the properties of it, there's 55 gigs of VHDs in there that are consuming 20 gigs of disk space.
Mm-hmm.
So what it's done is gone through at the block level and figured out what all the duplicate blocks are. And it's not compression. Right, compression tries to make the individual file smaller by eliminating white space.
Right.
It simply says, those two are the same, I'm just going to write a marker to it
right.
and only store it once. And it's a service that was traditionally only available on SANs that, you know, as we talked about yesterday, we're bubbling all that SAN functionality up to the file server. That's one of those pieces of functionality that's now been elevated from the SAN directly into the file server. Where that gets really important, by the way, not so much in pools, because pools, you get one base and you get all the diffs. In private, the underlying implementation model for Windows is to make a clone of the full VHD for every single desktop. So I have 5 private VHD files here. Let me take a look at this. I back this up just one notch here and I go, let's find all the VHD files. You can see here, I have 5 gig VHD files, or 25 and change gigs worth of space. And so what the dedupe job did was said those files are identical,
mm-hmm.
and just deduped them. And so this is where all the space savings actually came from. The big, you know, sort of complaint with this model of VDI with 2012 was the fact that if you do private, you go, you know, bang, 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 you use a lot of storage. And dedupe in 2012 did not dedupe live running VHDs.
Right. 2012
now
it does.
Can.
Right.
So I can now apply a dedupe policy to the store where the VHDs reside for my my private desktop pools, and it will dedupe the entire thing whether they're running or not. And so you get live space savings back. And so the first question that everybody's going to ask is performance hit. Yes, there is a little bit of a performance hit, but it's negligible. It's not something that you're going to, you know, see unless you sit there and measure IOPS down to the minute detail. Anything you add takes a performance, no matter what it is, right? If you add a layer of some form, you're going to get performance somewhere. But it's very, very, very efficient, very negligible. You're not going to see a visual performance hit from this. So,
thinking back also the tiered storage as well, though, because they're deduped, they're going to be hitting one area of a block that's going to become more hot and logically moves over to the faster tier if using tiered storage.
Yeah, and if I had a graph here at one stage, I think I closed it, but all these are basically residing in SSD right now.
Right. We have a nice slide here that summarizes some of the storage options that you have for this particular environment. You've got storage spaces, you've got SMB3 as an option for where you can go off and store your individual VHD files. Clustered server volume if you wanted to, scale-up file server, obviously, and then also online disk deduplication and also tiered storage is all leveraged by it. VDI storage configuration as well includes direct attached as well as all of the above. User profile disks and parent virtual hard disks and virtual machines can all be configured separately for each location if you want to get down to that level of minutia for pre-optimizing your own implementation for your own specific hardware for where they happen to go, that sort of stuff. And also, obviously, optimum use of high I/O operations and where they're going to be going from for speed of access for where they should be located. From a cost perspective, kind of like this one here. This is
actually a really good. You know, I'm a big fan of demos, but this is actually a really nice slide to kind of put this in perspective. So, have a look at this one, guys.
Pool virtual machines. Basic costs coming down to overall management costs, compute costs, and stand storage costs.
Yeah, look at like blue or purpley, purple or blue is management, purple is compute, which is like cost for RAM and CPU.
Right.
And then how many giggly bits do you need on disk?
So, you got it.
So the purple is giggly watts and the orange is giggly bits.
App V and disk deduplication can reduce your overall storage costs.
Absolutely.
For being able to make things available for things. Pooled virtual machines and user profile disk and application virtualization, as you mentioned, solving from the top down to where this goes. If you start off with that as the base, further reduces it down because you got storage for the OS images has been reduced, and also you have fewer images to manage overall because they're pooled nature, and you can schedule them to be patched, and you can do that with Config Manager so you prevent the patching storms that will take place potentially and everything else along those lines too. And then going off and using session-based virtualization instead, starting off with that as a base storage area and then significantly reducing it down because you have one image that you're going to be going off and managing.
Yeah, which is your terminal server, your
terminal
RDS
server,
or even you have an array of them for that matter. You know, it's a whole lot easier, and that is a very well-worn path. The only big significant, well, there's two limiting factors with terminal server type stuff. The first is not all apps will run on it.
Right.
And so you will find there was one implementation I did with a client where they had to go with pooled VDI because the vendor didn't license the app for terminal server. It worked, but the licensing prohibited that.
Yeah.
Which to me is a really dumb reason to have to go that route, but that was the reason they had to go that route.
Yeah.
So not all apps work. And then on terminal server, you don't have admin access. You're user level, so you mightn't be able to get away with that.
Mm-hmm. Going on even further, the fact that you're able to go off and possibly use direct attached storage and or use, as we were going through all yesterday, the whole concept of storage pools and storage spaces instead to reduce your overall SAN costs.
Which is a much simpler, easier way to get a file share to a user than building a file cluster and then plumbing Fibre Channel or iSCSI into it.
Right.
So if you can do it all in one box and present that as a cluster in a box, that is a simple, cheap, and easy way to get SAN equivalent performance out to out over a file share in a small footprint.
And I do got to do a shout out to the guys that are answering all the questions inside of our live chat. If you're watching this live, Tommy Patterson's doing an awesome job.
Yeah,
Chris Amos is doing an awesome
job. They're doing a great
staying on
job
top of this, and also Chris as well. So good job, guys, for staying on top of that. I'm trying to also bubble up anything that happens to not be answered. So hit the team option and it jumps up at me in case I need to go off and see it. Now, from a high availability perspective, scale-out file server and Hyper-V clustering as architecturally as what you'd be using for an individual design for how this can go. You can run it out very quickly as a quick deploy, quick config, just to be able to go off and try it out and how that works. But then going and doing a proper architecture, as you mentioned, top down, deal with the user stuff, deal with the app stuff, and then worry about, okay, how am I going to make the desktops available to individual
people?
If
you're doing a VDI implementation, you know, you kind of you send two projects out on by themselves, right? So you go, all right, guys, we're doing VDI, so user state and application guys, you go do your thing and give me user state and app virtualization. Fabric guys, give me highly available Hyper-V servers and highly available storage. And when you have both of those things,
come back and let's talk.
You come back and you build VDI. And so you don't want to, when you're deploying VDI, worry about, you know, your high availability of the fabric or the user state. You want to focus on high availability of the VDI components,
right?
Like the brokers and the gateways and all that kind of stuff. That's where you want to be focused on. So it can run on highly available file shares, highly available Hyper-V clusters, SAN implementations, traditional fiber channel, iSCSI. It's all transparent to VDI. It's just storage. It's a place to put files. That's all it is.
Improve active broker capabilities now.
Right. You don't want like your connection broker is kind of the heart of everything. If it goes down, everything's broken.
Right.
So the connection broker can be made highly available. We've got a bit of an illustration of that coming up in a few minutes.
And then obviously up to different numbers of nodes of your virtualization farm, and then also your density of using your remote desktop services session host potentially is going to give you more to individual virtual machines.
So here's how you basically go from simple to highly available.
Right. You've got a Windows Server 2012. You've got high availability, active for your different mode brokers, and being able to go off and use, obviously, SQL Server for your database backend for your remote brokers desktop connection. You then are able to go off and scale out additional loads for adding new web access servers, adding new gateway servers, maybe putting on different levels of authentication required for those different gateway servers, being able to build out more clustering as far as your licensing is concerned.
So like a big question is like, well, how do you achieve this? For the RD web access, you do an IIS web firm. So look up, how do I make IIS highly available? And that's how you make web access highly available. It's also how you make the gateway highly available. Mm-hmm. In terms of the licensing, it's a service. You can cluster it traditionally, either guest or host clustering. And then for the virtualization host, you do Hyper-V clustering.
Hyper-V clustering.
And then for remote session hosts, terminal server session host farms, which are tried and true, and there's tons of stuff out there, and they're easy, you know, and straightforward to do, and it's not a new thing by no stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm.
With remote desktop connection broker, you obviously can go through and protect your SQL database for what's going to be running off of it with doing SQL Server clustering as well.
You can have more than one connection broker. If you have more than one connection broker, they need a shared data store.
Right.
They can you can use the little built-in one in Windows, or you can say use a real honest-to-God SQL Server and spin off a third project, which is, hey, SQL DBAs, I need a SQL Server database that's not going to go down.
Right.
And believe me, they know how to do that.
Yeah. Some experience changes. So we talked about the architecture, talked about going in and doing the deployments, and talked about architecting this to be more resilient and highly available, that sort of stuff as well. From an experience perspective, changes in 2012 to 2012 R2?
There's a number of them. And, you know, we talked about all the, you know, you and I are server guys and fabric guys, so we get all excited about wires and cables and disks. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much of that stuff I put in. If Andy the accountant sits down on his virtual desktop and goes, this sucks, it's all failed.
Why is my page taking so long to redraw?
And that's all based on the bandwidth and protocols that go from his device to his virtual desktop and making sure that that experience is rich, because it doesn't matter how great the back end is, if it's not as good as local, it's going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I've seen VDI projects get completely tanked because the VP went in and used the virtual desktop on his cable modem at home at 8 o'clock at night when everybody else is torrenting down illegal videos. And, you know, it sucked.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, well, VDI sucks. And VDI went away, despite they had a phenomenal implementation of it. So you go back to those four items that are there on that slide. RemoteFX for WAN. RemoteFX is a confusing thing.
We've got some build slides to talk about that's coming up, architecturally.
Right, architecturally. But RemoteFX, as a definition, is a confusing thing. When RemoteFX first came out, with Windows Server 2008 R2, I believe it was. It was a way of getting 3D graphics capability into a virtual machine. that's not what it is by definition anymore. Now RemoteFX is a protocol extension for RDP that's just there and makes RDP better over WAN links. With 2008, RemoteFX was not for the WAN, it was for the LAN. With 2012 and 2012 R2, it's for the WAN now. And it's designed to tune the experience, change the way stuff renders on the screen so that it's optimal over a slower WAN link. There's support for both a physical and a virtual GPU. With Windows Server 2012, you now have a virtual GPU that's present in every VM, but you can still, for very high-end applications, have a physical GPU. Whether this is a graphics card that's in the server that you present as a GPU, and it's got to be a DirectX, I think 11 capable. There's a slide that lists it. It's a DirectX capable card, and there are companies like NVIDIA that sell rack-mounted video cards. Where you can actually rack mount an entire video card with a special cable to a server and support very high density VDI implementations. Rick, you were looking at a VDI implementation you were telling me about, I believe it was from Dell a little bit ago.
Yeah, Dell actually announced a tech at North America. They announced and launched what they call the Vertex server, which was their version of a cluster-in-a-box solution. That was a four-node cluster-in-a-box that had gobs of RAM on each one of the different nodes.
Gobs
of RAM on the individual nodes. And then they had a massive amount of storage drives inside of it. Literally, if you tried to lift this thing up, it was easily 150 to 200 pounds because of the sheer amount of weight that's inside of it. The architecture for the way they laid it out has shared video slots that were able to go and plug these GPUs inside of. That would then be able to be used by the different servers, which is, again, just phenomenally cool what they do. With that particular implementation they were showing off, they had over 600 and change, not exact number, 600 and change VDI sessions available for everything on a single box.
That's awesome. All right, so jump back on the slide. And then, so USB redirection is now supported through RemoteFX for any kind of device, not just hard drives. But you can plug a video camera in, it'll just work.
Barcode readers, whatever.
Anything at all.
Printers.
And then full 10-point multi-touch. Mm-hmm. So you can put 10 fingers in an RDP session if you've got the right client level and the right server level, and it'll do 10-point multi-touch, which is real neat.
You got it. Adaptive graphics, being able to work on different types of monitors, crisp text and visibility for what it looks like for being able to do it, the ability to go through and reconnect up for different features, for movement across different types of devices, serve desktop apps to Windows RT device tablet users. Yep. Actually, an interesting one with this one here. I was approached by one of the developer guys in my team that was asking. He was about to go off on a trip to China, I think it was, and he had his RT device that was relatively new at the time, and he wanted to be able to use Visual Studio on RT. It's like, well, you can't run Visual Studio on RT because it's not designed to run an RT processor. And so I'm like, well, we got a VDI implementation. We can just go in and stand up a Visual Studio image on a VDI desktop and then publish that app out to that individual, and boom, lo and behold, he made a connection back into that session server and was able to go in and to get access to that one published app.
Soon as you you connect to a VDI implementation with remote app, it's going to populate right on your start menu. So you just get a tile. You touch the tile, and it goes in through the gateway if needed, launches the remote app, and actually logs you on and puts it right on your screen.
Right.
So it becomes literally just another peer member of that application community that's living on your machine.
Mm-hmm. It's full single sign-on for being able to do that. You authenticate a local machine, you're going to be able to go off and get access to the different apps. Remote app programs integrate easily into your local desktop like a native experience. Unless you really look closely, you don't even know that you're doing this.
But the only thing you would often get is the title bar theme might be different. Those are usually the simple, obvious things.
Yep. Now from RemoteFX, you mentioned this one here, delivers consistency across user experiences regardless if they're working over top of a LAN or a WAN environment, regardless of your deployment model. The idea is that you're going to be using both hardware and software GPUs. It gives you rich multimedia experience on your remote device and USB redirection, and also is able to give you, as you mentioned, multi-touch and also possibly WAN acceleration and single sign-on as well. Logistically, how this is kind of working with adaptive graphics. If you take a look at a very typical thing you're going to be doing, browsing the web.
This is You know, how remote effects works better over a WAN link. Whereas in the past, this would be chunky and staggered. Mm-hmm. Have a look at what it is now.
The idea is that it goes through and builds it out and looks for the environment, which is basically text-based, to make sure that comes up very quickly and fast inside your environment when you're going off and browsing this with a client perspective. It then goes through and looks for image content as well, and then starts to be able to identify these things as having to come down with a different priority, and then looks at moving content, or video animations, or GIFs, or whatever it is, if you haven't already blocked them with different blockers. It makes them available to come down as well. And the idea is that it comes in basically with a progressive rendering. It starts off with like a cloudy, fuzzy version of the different graphics center stuff.
It's the pixelization of it, so to speak.
Yeah. And then it gradually gets better, and then gradually gets better, and gradually gets better to the point where it's finally done.
Yeah. So you're not
sitting there waiting on it because the text is there immediately.
Yeah, if you're quickly scrolling through, you don't care if they're fuzzy because you're not interested. But by the time you get the one you're interested in, it's clear again. So
if you determine basically you're on a very fast connection, it's going to be going and using progressive running very fast. If it's on a slow network, then it's going to use progressive rendering. It's going to kick in the best experience overall, going pixelated first, then gradually getting clear, then gradually getting to the crispness level of where it's at. So remote effects for WAN combines the adaptive graphics with intelligent WAN aware transports to get down to it. It's going to be using either TCP or secure UDP to transport it down.
And actually, that's a big point, right? And we didn't even mention this. With RDP on Windows 8, if the connection's good enough, it'll go to UDP-based traffic. Mm-hmm. And that by itself is a phenomenal improvement in the user experience because it's not connection. I mean, you don't got to go back and forth every time there's an update. It just sends them out. And if you drop a few UDP packets, well, there's a bunch more coming right behind it.
Yep.
So it's not a big deal. And you put Windows 7 side by side with Windows 8 on, you know, if you go Windows 7 to Windows 2008, Windows 8 to 2012, just on a LAN, and you stream a high-def video, you see the difference that UDP makes.
Oh, totally. Totally.
You can't even tell anymore.
Mm-hmm. Some other stuff with remote effects. From a streaming perspective, it supports redirection of Luna's media files coming down. It decreases bandwidth consumption by 90% as one possible look at it because of the way that it handles it. Dynamic codecs that can go through different bit rates for server-side video, it's all available to come down. USB redirection is used with a variety of different types of scenarios. As we mentioned, physical, virtual, and session desktop. You don't need to have a specific GPU to be able to use this. And it's able to go in and use a variety of different types of peripherals. As you mentioned, it's no longer just readers of any kind or hard drives it's going through. It actually is a bunch of different solutions that are out there. It does USB redirection through the session. So yeah, very good stuff.
Worth noting that there's a lot of settings for remote effects, and they can be controlled through group policy. So there's a couple of group policy nodes for remote effects. If you're doing this corporate wide, and you know you want to turn it off, for example, or you want to force it to go, force it to performance versus bandwidth utilization, or favor lower utilization for higher performance, then you can actually control a lot of that through group policy.
Yep. Now, from a GPU perspective, as you mentioned, CPU is able to go through and emulate software-based GPU to be able to go through and use CPU power to be able to bring stuff down. Or you're able to use a RemoteFX virtual GPU as well to bring it down for 3D graphics intensive, full animations and transitions, best of application compatibility, and everything else that's there.
All right. New for
specifically
R2.
New for R2.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So this
one
is a good
slide one. To summarize it all for what's specifically new for R2.
Yeah, we mentioned it's incremental improvement, right. not earth shattering improvement.
But it's leveraging all the underlying technologies that are built into the server.
All the earth shattering stuff happened from 2008 to 2012.
Right.
So dynamically, I had to remove monitors. Personal annoyance of mine: if you RDP to something, you have dual screen, and you disconnect your monitor, your RDP session is now scrolly.
It's missed it, right?
And
it's
it'll actually shrink it back to one screen again. So it's dynamically, as you add and remove monitors, the RDP session can dynamically achieve that. Remote app behavior is a little bit better. They've better integrated that with the local system to make remote apps even more seamless. The reconnects are quicker now. Mm-hmm. So if you get disconnected, you get stuck in that, one of 20, wait, two of 20, and then by five of 20 it reconnects. That's been tidied up a lot. So now it's a lot quicker. And then finally, they've done a lot of work with the codecs within RemoteFX just to make video streaming better. Because video streaming, you want it to be rich, but you don't want to consume all the bandwidth. And that's where those improvements come from. And I don't have a very specific list other than they're better. That's really all I know. So anything in the Q&A we want to address before we start to wrap this guy up? I don't think
so. I guess the question is, you know, along the lines, you know, what about Link? Will audio and video work over a a session to get into there?
Yes. So with Link, there's actually the big thing people often ask about is video. Voice works fine. Video on Windows 7, there's actually an add-on you can get for RDP to enable webcam redirection.
Yep.
On 8, webcam redirection just works.
Yep.
So you have no issues with Link in that scenario. So, so Link works fine in VDI.
We had Karen Lee was asking us about that RT scenario. You can serve up any Windows-based 8 app to an RT device.
You can serve up any terminal server-based app.
Right, let's clarify that. Yeah, it doesn't matter what processor architecture is designed for, because it's coming through a session. You're literally just getting the virtualized desktop.
It's just an RDP version of the app. It just runs there. The only thing running locally is the RDP client. It's all running on the server.
This is all built in.
Yep.
It's all good. Anything else that's in there? Anything? USB redirection, still have the same original device and class ID. It basically just passes it through. VDI implementation, Link client, already answered that one there. You know what? I think we basically got everything.
I think we're good.
Anything that you can think of from the demo that we missed?
No, we've kind of done all the big stuff. If you want, you know, all the real gory details in that, have a look at the Jumpstart Joey and I did. We've got some really good stuff in there. Some really good discussions as well on, you know, when you go private or pooled and how you address all those things. And because I haven't seen a lot of this come through, but usually one of the questions that comes up a lot is licensing.
Mm-hmm.
Because licensing for VDI looks really, really confusing. It's actually not. And Adam Carter, who's one of the program managers for VDI, came in that Jumpstart and did a session on VDI licensing. And so if you're wondering about licensing, it's one of the best explanations I've ever heard in my life.
Plain simple.
He sat
terms.
Down and went, here's how it works. There's two things, and explained it in about 15 minutes. So, you know, if you're looking at licensing, I'm not even going to try. You're not even going to try.
Correct.
Have a look at that one. It will answer every one of your licensing questions in about 15 minutes, I guarantee.
Yeah. I've got the link on the slide up here for where those particular sessions would reside under MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com. Notice that I updated this to have the proper links to be able to get the software
again.
You
did.
You can download a copy of the release preview for 2012 R2 from aka.ms/ws2012r2. You can also download them from System Center 2012 R2 as well, aka.ms/sc2012r2. And I haven't even been checking the Twitters to find out what's been going on.
The Twitters are a twittering. There's a lot of twittering about your hat, to be quite honest, Rick.
Nice.
Apparently, your hat's the CEO of Contoso. Did you know that?
I thought he was just the IT person.
No,
I didn't even know he existed.
Apparently, your hat's the CEO of Contoso. So
nice.
That's, the makeup lady's apparently coming in to give it a touch-up. There's a spot right there.
There's a spot on the hat. I didn't clean it up. Oh, I didn't know that. For those of you that are joining the live stream, we will be picking back up again, not at the top of the hour, because that would make it so that we only have a short break. So we're actually going to be picking this back up again at 1 p.m.
Pacific
Daylight Time if you're watching this live.
By my clock, that's 1 hour and 8 minutes.
Right.
Now.
If you're looking at this in a replay mode, don't worry. You simply click on next for the next option, and you get to go on the next one. I'll be joined by my good friend Adam Hall. Talking about PCIT and experiences with multiple different devices.
I would warn you, if you watch all these videos in sequence, we're going to be way more tired by the end of it than if you watch them and give us a break in between. So the quality will go down if you watch them all one after the other, trust me.
So we'll be joining you after lunch for some stuff on PCIT, work folders and really cool stuff along those lines for access information protection. And we'll be wrapping up the day with some stuff on web and IIS and other things along those lines. Thanks a lot for joining us. We'll see you after the break, and have a good one.
Take care.